Yo, what is a cipher?
I gotta make a song called Janet Reno.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 116, a talk with Luther Campbell. Since starting his career as a DJ in Miami in the late 1970s, Campbell has been an innovator musically, culturally, business-wise, and even legally. As the mastermind behind 2 Live Crew, he guided the group's change from a California-based conscious rap group into a pioneering Southern crew who popularized Miami-based music and whose raunchy lyrics were often imitated. It was those same raunchy lyrics that would land Campbell and the group in repeated legal hot water. Luke fought and won legal battles not only for his group's right to be, as his most popular and controversial record would have it, as nasty as they want to be, but also for record stores' right to sell his work. He also took a battle to parody songs all the way to the Supreme Court, and won. Simultaneously, he was running the fiercely independent Luke Records, which was, for a time, the largest Black-owned record label in the country, and discovering acts like Poison Clan, Trick Daddy, and Pitbull. Luke has also been fiercely devoted to the children of his native Liberty City neighborhood, starting a popular youth football league, coaching teams himself, and even running for mayor of Miami in 2011. Uncle Luke's latest venture is a memoir that covers his wild life and times, as well as the history of his hometown. It's called The Book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City, published by Amistad. We talked to Luther Campbell via Skype from, of course, Miami. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure to subscribe in your podcast app of choice. That way you'll get every new episode right when it comes out. It's also a great way to explore our back catalog, including episode 102, further talk about the history of Miami hip-hop with one of its most influential practitioners, DJ EFN. You can also find more information about this show, including a playlist, at thecyphershow.com. And now, the raunchiest guy ever to hold court on Donahue, Luther Campbell. You know, when I read the book, a surprising amount of it, at least to me, was devoted to the history of Miami and the ways specifically in which racism kind of shaped the development of the entire city. Why was that important to put in a book about your life? Why is that history important for people to understand you?
To get a good idea as to who I am and how I've been basically prepared to deal with all the other adverse situations that I had to go through in the music business. I think it was important to understand where I came from, to understand what I've been through and where I'm at. I'm a guy that likes to have people understand the root of it all. So that's why that was kind of important. When I'm dealing with controversy between whether the music was free speech, those different battles that I had to fight, people needed to kind of get an idea as what made him become that type of person to be able to deal with these different issues. But knowing where I came from gave you a good idea as to, oh, okay, I get it. This guy was basically built for what he's dealing with right now, with the controversy of free speech.
That makes perfect sense. Now, you know, hip hop, obviously, in its history, has this founding trauma of the Cross Bronx Expressway, right? The highway that ruined the Bronx, and that had a lot to do with the beginnings of hip hop. But Miami had its own version of that, like 40 years earlier with I-95. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I-95, our historical area was Overtown. And that's basically where majority of the African Americans in Miami lived at, include my mother, grandfather, and my mother's entire family. And through a, you know, same situation as like say with the Bronx, what they did was they took I-95 and ran it right through Overtown, which was the worst thing that ever happened to, you know, Miami's only African-American community, along with the other things that they were doing to discourage African-Americans. I mean, because when you really, when you think about it and you look at the history of it, you know, the people who really built Miami were people from the Bahamas. Bahamians came in, moved into Overtown, lived there, built Miami, and at the same time had a whole, you know, I mean, when they lived there, it was entertainment. You had everything going on in Overtown, similar to what you have had in Harlem, where it was a vibrant area, you know, in Liberty City, where we eventually ended up moving. That was mostly a white neighborhood. And one part of Liberty City, you had, you know, affordable housing, you know, government housing, which is called the Liberty Square projects, you know, with a wall set up right there. So you had different pockets, but the main area was Overtown. And when they ran that highway through it, it just tore apart the entire community. People start scattering and going everywhere. People start moving to Coconut Grove. People start moving to Liberty City. And it was, you know, it was a part of, okay, this is, you know, this area we want to now take over, you know, the powers that be in Miami to be able to build the condos and different things that they have in the Overtown downtown area right now.
And then like maybe 20, 25 years after that, they shut down the black high school, right? Booker T. Washington High in 67.
Yes.
In the book, Luther writes, "For the first 30 years of Miami's history, there was no black high school at all. Public education for blacks didn't go past the eighth grade. In 1927, they opened Booker T. Washington High. That was ours. But in many ways, it was an illusion. Because once Brown vs. Board of Ed came along and they started trying to desegregate the city schools, we didn't have any control over how it played out. The wealthy white neighborhoods, they were protected. They had the political clout to make sure their kids didn't have to go anywhere. It was only the average working and middle class whites who had to deal with us coming in. And the black community, once desegregation started, we didn't have the clout to protect what was important to us. In 1967, they shut down Booker T. Washington High and turned it into a middle school. All its kids were being separated and bused across town. It had a devastating impact on the community. Right there, it set off a lot of the hate and the mistrust. I didn't understand it at the time, but my parents would talk about it, and later I saw it as an adult. It started when they plowed Interstate 95 through the heart of Black Miami. But when they closed Booker T., that was the last straw. It was like, what are y'all trying to do? Y'all fucking the town. Y'all just stuck a fucking expressway through the middle of our neighborhood, and then you close up the number one black high school? They started taking shit away from us, and we didn't feel like we were getting much in return. After everything they promised us with the civil rights movement, they were closing down our institutions, but they weren't really opening the door to their side of opportunity. All white private schools were springing up everywhere. By 1969, we'd lost Booker T. Washington High, but 42 of the 217 public schools in Dade County were still all black. Whites were fighting us in court. White parents in Miami Beach sued to stop their kids from being bussed out into black neighborhoods, but they didn't fight us being bussed over there.
Now, you were pretty young then. Did you realize at the time what a turning point that was? And if not, when did you kind of start to figure that out?
I was very, very, just like you said, I was very, very young. I remember, you know, all the big classic football games. I remember, a lot of the things, a lot of the major events that were going on in Overtown, because we hung out Overtown because that's where my granddad and everybody lived at. I mean, when I started realizing what was going on within the city was from my, like I said in the book, my great uncle, Uncle Ricky. You know, when I would go over to his house on the weekends, and he would explain to me the history, along with my dad, the history of Miami and some of the things that he had to go through, because he was pretty much one of the first African-American contractors. He owned a painting company. And, you know, so he had to go through some things painting, you know, and all, again, all that side of my mother's part of the family were from the Bahamas. So they had a rich history in telling me these are the things that took place before. This is where we're at now. And if you don't watch out, then you'll end up getting those invisible chains put on you along the way. So, you know, he taught me a lot about life, how to read the newspaper, how to read within the newspaper and look at the news and see the subliminal messages that was, you know, not directed toward African Americans, but other folks.
You know, you've talked about those invisible chains for years now, and it's kind of a central theme of the book, you know, and what you learned from your uncle. And, you know, you mentioned your dad in passing. When he bought a house, you know, in Liberty City, there was this magic thing that happened where all of a sudden the down payment went up by 400% once the seller realized he was Black.
Yes, yes.
And that's the kind of thing that, like, you know, when that happened in, you know, post-World War II, that's the kind of thing that just now people are starting to reckon with again. There was a big article in The Atlantic that Ta-Nehisi Coates did that kind of went through some of that history. Have you been aware that kind of people have been talking about that sort of era of like redlining and housing discrimination post-war recently? Have you seen any of that?
I haven't seen any of that, but it doesn't surprise me because when you look at, you know, a lot, and that's why it was so important to talk about the history, you know, and then, you know, and then talk about me, because when you, a lot of people think of me, you know, oh, this, he's Miami. But I, you know, is, yeah, you know, Luke, if it's a hip hop artist or if it's somebody in the industry or somebody just know me, they need to know the history first. And just like you say, you know, these things are the same things. A lot of things that were happening back then are happening now, and they continuously happen. You know, even when the housing market crashed, you know, they were giving all these people who couldn't afford houses loans, and knowing that the market was going to crash, to be able to take that little bit of money from them, then resell these houses. So a lot of these things have been going on for the longest. And so it doesn't surprise me about that right now.
Mm-hmm. So moving to kind of your career a little bit, we had a guest on here a few weeks ago, Oliver Wang, who's an author, and he wrote a book about the mobile DJ scene in San Francisco in the Bay Area that took place, you know, probably late 70s to early 90s, kind of starting right around the time that you were getting involved in DJ crews in Miami. Were you aware at the time that, like, hey, there are crews of DJs in other cities throwing parties as well?
I was pretty much aware that there were, you know, we knew about the crews that was in New York. We knew about the DJs in Jamaica, you know. In San Francisco, no, we didn't, because back then, there was no Source magazines. There were no Vibe magazines. There was no information being distributed about what's happening to another city. You know, you heard about New York. That was about it with the Grandmaster Flash and Herc and all those guys. But then you didn't really know anything outside of that until I got in to deeper into the music industry and I started traveling to Oakland and San Francisco. Then I started hearing about these DJs and Mr. Mix from San Bernardino, the whole Jazzy Jeff in Philadelphia. You know, once I started traveling, I then started realizing that there are some historical guys that are doing basically the same thing, maybe a little different. Maybe it's mixing, but not necessarily talking over the microphone. But they were doing the same thing that we were doing and I was doing for the longest.
So what were those early days of DJ crews like in Miami, even before you got involved and right when you kind of joined up with the ghetto style DJs? What was that scene like? Who were some of the other players? What kind of stuff, you know, what was that like?
I mean, it was a thing to be. I mean, everybody know Miami right now for the greatest state for football players. Back then, I mean, the end thing was to be involved in the as a DJ. I mean, when you're a DJ, you get all the girls as well as make all the money because you were able to go in and do parties on the park, you know, on a Sunday. And then throughout the weekend, you would go to a high school on a Friday and then they would go to a skating rink on a Saturday. And you had like DJ groups from Soul Survivor DJs to South Miami DJs. They were some of the hot DJ groups. Back then you had international DJs. You know, those were some of the top groups that you would want to aspire to be like.
Mm-hmm. You you joined the ghetto style DJs, and largely I think they let you in because you had a van, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a startup group. The guys had about two speakers at the time, and then, you know, they had no way of transporting it. Then I came in. They needed a guy with a van, and they said, "Hey, man, you want to be in the group?" Okay, fine. So I hopped in the group. I was the guy that had a van, and, you know, I ended up being somewhat of the business manager of the group as well as a DJ. And, you know, saying, "Hey, look, we need to build more speakers. We need to go talk to principals at schools and skating rinks. We need to be more business involved. And, you know, hopefully at someday we'll own our own team disco." And that's when everybody kind of looked at me like I was crazy.
Which, of course, would eventually happen with Pac Jam 2. So what kind of records were you playing in those days? I know you were always on the hunt for more obscure things, but what were kind of the go-to records when you first started out with like 78, 79, right? Right around there?
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, I would play like Herman Kelly in Life. Songs like Brothers Johnson. Herbie Hancock. Then, you know, I was kind of one of the first ones to start playing reggae because before I started DJing, I was, you know, I was more so like a kid that would make a lot of what they call now mixtapes, but they weren't really necessarily mixtapes. They were just tapes from the record to the 8-track tape. And I would, you know, sell them to my friends across the street and some of my other buddies who had, you know, some of the other guys, older guys who had cassette tapes in their car out of their house.
And those would be just mixes you would put together, like basically a DJ set?
Yes, yes. And that's basically how I started. And I was doing that on my mother's stereo because it was able to be able to tape from the vinyl to the 8-track. So I would do that, and that would get me familiar with a lot of music. And, you know, and on the weekends, my mother and my dad would be playing music. The music would start off in the morning with Burt Bacharach. And we would end up at night when the drinking start, my mom and them would end up with Millie Jackson.
I was right there waiting on him to tell him all them sweet things I know his wife hadn't told him over the holidays. And you can think of a whole lot of good stuff to tell a nigga when you're by yourself. So the minute my man came in the Doja 1, I started laying it on him. I said, "Ooh, baby. Ooh, baby."
So it went from one extreme to the next. From the next. You'd have Burt Bacharach playing while you cleaning the house. And then, you know, once the house clean and the mom out there in the backyard with all her friends, then we end up with Millie Jackson.
What were sometimes euphemistically called party records back in the
exactly,
days.
Exactly. Yeah. Clean up woman and all that. Betty Wright.
A clean up woman is a woman.
You know, it got deeper and deeper as the day went on. So, you know, and you know, me, you know, I was like different. I would take, you know, like I said, I would go to these record pool clubs and I look through the through the records, and I play original concept, stuff like that. You know, like I say before, you know, I was into Cameo, the Barcades, Earth, Wind & Fire. You know, Quincy Jones was one of my favorite. You know, that Mellow Madness album. You know, I was all over the place, and, you know, in my short period of time when I, you know, tried to, you know, smoke a marijuana joint, then I ended up into Peter Frampton and Steve Miller Band and people like that at one period. So I was kind of, my music, I was all over the place. You know, I just love music.
Yeah, and reggae was always in the DJ battles, right? Reggae was kind of your trick, was kind of your secret weapon.
Yeah, reggae was my secret weapon because just like I say, the guys across the street who lived from me, they were all Rastafarians. And when I would make their reggae reggae music, 8-tracks, you know, I'm sitting there listening to all these songs. But at the same time, I would have my family members, my dad's side of the family, they would come visit throughout the summertime to come over here and shop in Miami, and so they would bring music, and, you know, my dad would be listening to that, and I would be listening to the reggae music, and so I would take the most popular reggae songs, because here in Miami, it was all about bass, and then I would take that music and say, okay, I'm gonna trick these people with that in the battles, because that had a little more bass than a regular record.
Yeah, and you kind of have, in the book, you kind of lay out, I've been jokingly calling it the Grand Unified Theory of Miami Bass that I've kind of never heard anywhere, right? Like, people from the islands brought, you know, this kind of style of music, and then you had Latin people bringing Latin percussion, and kind of the unifying idea was bass. Is that something how did you figure that out? Like I said, I've never heard, you know, the history of how Miami bass came to be phrased quite in that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was. I mean, you know, getting with Mr. Mix, you know, who the guy was putting this, all this stuff together, and me and him would sit there countless hours, and I would be like, hey, look, we can't sound like New York, we can't sound like California, we can't sound like Egyptian Lover. You know, and all that stuff that was going on out there, this is what it is. You know, we have Jamaicans, we have Bahamians, we have Puerto Ricans, we have Cubans, we have all types of, it's a melting pot. So we have to make the music. You know, we got to have that reggae bass.
How can a man live happily in the presence of so many wicked? How can a man live happily?
And we got to have the tempo with a little calypso, you know, from the Bahamas.
I dream I was in Africa, and I was a warrior.
And then we got to have that Latino with the congas and all that. And the tempo has to be at least 125 beats a minute. You know, obviously he looked at me like I was crazy.
Right.
When he said it, it was like, hold on, man. Hip hop is only 90 beats per minute, if that. You know, 60 to 90. And I was like, nah, well, that's what they do. This is what we going to do. You know, because at the time when I was DJing, all of the records, we had to speed up. You know, we couldn't leave the records at the same tempo because, you know, we're a high energy town. So, you know, we would speed it up to almost 78, a regular 33 song.
Wow. And you mentioned Egyptian Lover there. Is it true that he's the one who showed you how to first use a 808?
Luke was a promoter in Miami, and he hired me to do a concert. So I went out there and did a concert, and we had another show the following night. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do the next show live. Instead of just playing a record, I'm going to play a drum machine. So I told him what kind of drum machine, and we had to go rent one. So I rented one, and he watched me program the whole show on a drum machine. And he said, wow, man, teach me how to do that. So I taught him how to do that.
Egyptian Lover. No, Mr. Mix basically showed me. I don't know if Egyptian Lover showed him, because they were in the same on the same label at the time.
You obviously spent a lot of time with the ghetto style DJs, and you got into concert promotion and bringing New York artists down to Miami. And I have to ask, by the way, one of the artists in the list of people you brought down was Mantronix. And like, not many people know much about Curtis. Do you remember what he was like to interact with?
Oh, man. He probably was, if not one of the most brilliantest producers, minded hip hop artists, producers that I've ever been around. I mean, his music, and again, you know, just like you say, that he doesn't get too much credit for his place in hip hop, which is kind of sad. I mean, that, you know, back then it was about being different, you know, and being creative, you know, unlike it is now. And Curtis was very, very creative, because you could always do use the same beat, sound the same way, and all that. You know, that's easy to do. But I mean, when Mantronix came out, it was totally different, and it was electronic. It was hip hop. It was different. It was totally different than what anybody else was doing. So that kind of, you know, that interests me. And we start playing the music, playing the songs. I played it first down here and broke the records and eventually brought them down to perform, and people loved them.
Nice. And, you know, earlier today I was on my way to our studio, and I texted my producer and I said, hey, check out 2 Live Crew's first single. And I sent him Revelations.
A revolution of mass confusion, brothers killing each other, robbing their mother, father, sister, and brother. They don't want to get a job or go to school. They think it's cool, but they're playing the fool. It's now 1984, 500 years later. We're dominating both sides of the equator in sports, music, and making love. But yet we still have trouble rising above.
And I think a lot of people would be surprised.
Very surprised.
That the very first single from 2 Live Crew is kind of this message ripoff, but religious.
Conscience.
Yeah.
Hey, I tell them all the time, I say, Common wasn't the first conscience rapper. It was 2 Live Crew.
Yeah.
And people like, huh? You know, and then I tell them, I say, you know, we wasn't the first dirty rap group. Neither. We didn't do explicit lyrics first. It was more like Schoolie D. Mm-hmm. Schoolie D was swearing on record.
I say one thing, he says another. What's that word you be saying, motherfucker? I guess it's all right, man. I don't care, but I might skin your mama out of underwear.
And then you had Dougie Fresh even. Slick Rick even swearing on records.
She says, no, you're not. Then she starts crying. I says, I'm 19. She said,
stop lying.
I says, I am. Go ask my mother. And with your wrinkled pussy, I can't be your lover.
So it was, you know, a lot of people think we were the only ones at the time, but technically we wasn't.
Yeah. So that song, like you said, is kind of strange. And people might be surprised that you decided to bring that group to Miami and kind of try to make them stars. What was it about the early incarnation of the 2 Live Crew that you were like, I'm going to throw my lot in with these guys?
Well, it was more so the flip side of Revelation, which was the song Beatbox.
So get on the floor, take a chance. This is the time you get to dance.
Yeah. beatbox kind of fit the mold of music that we were playing down here because it was beat, 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 beatbox. It was more of a dance-oriented song that we could speed up, you know, that we could speed up. And it had some 808 in it and had a little drop in it, but it fit a dance record. So, you know, like I say, I got with the guys, saw the record in the record pool crate, called up the number that was on there, and it was Mr. Mick's telephone number. And I told him, look, I'm going to break this record. Y'all guys going to be hot in Miami before you know it. So once I did that, when I brought them down the first time, they were like, yo, we're in the military. I was like, how y'all do that? You know, I didn't know whether it was legal or not legal.
To hear them tell it, it wasn't really legal. Like, they got away with it, but they really weren't supposed to be that far off base.
Nah, they weren't supposed to be that far off base. And they were flying down to Miami doing shows. And I would bring them down all the time because, you know, we ended up becoming, you know, bonding. And like I say, you know, when they said, hey, look, we need help because when this Mercola Records company is not doing it for us and they're not helping our career, I said in the book, I didn't know anything about being a record company. I always wanted to be this great promoter. And I eventually ended up getting into producing music and putting out records.
Well, I'm very glad you became the first Luther Campbell instead of the second Bill Graham, I have to say.
I know, right? Because I sure enough wanted to be, old Bill Graham, Al Heyman. My whole thing was, okay, I want to be a concert promoter.
Right. And so 2 Live Crew, you've said this, and I, as far as I can tell, you're right, that 2 Live Crew was literally the first rap group in the South, you know, once you move them from California to Miami. So given that there were no real rap groups in the South, what on earth made you think it was a good idea to move them down South and to have them become the first rap group there?
I mean, it was, let me tell you, everything was, you know, I always, back then, and even right now, everything was like common sense. It was just happening. You know, these guys were like, yo, we're getting out of the Army in another year. Okay, we're going to move down there and we're going to start, do music. We were doing music while they were still in the service. They got out of the service. Then everything, it was just, the timing was perfect. And then I'm starting this record company and not knowing what I'm doing. I'm just using common sense, you know, and learning, you know, from what I knew by hanging out at the radio station, asking one person, asking another person, going to music conventions, you know, listening to what other people do in the music business. So I'm just learning as I went on. You know, at the same time, using common sense, you know, and how to get the records to people. And, you know, guys, just like I say, the guys moved down. They wanted to be in Miami. And we started doing this Miami music. They started, you know, doing the Miami music. And before you know it, it was, you know, everybody was here. We had to change the group up because Yuri, the guy who did the Revelation song, he did not want to do any explicit lyrics. Anything like that, you know, it was already always set as to what he wanted to do by the beatbox song. If you notice, he wasn't on that track. It was just Chris. He was on one side of the record, and Chris was on the other side of the record. So we kind of then took the dance part of that. Then I pretty much brought in the adult version of it, saying, "Look, we gotta be different." Everybody else, ain't nobody else doing this. And so me and Mix kind of bonded real good together. Because we were just on the same level and the same mindset.
Yeah, and you know, you guys made Throw the D.
It's a brand new dance and it's coming your way. It was started in Miami, better get a DJ. Say some call it nasty, but that's not true. Just the only dance that you can do. Cause you need a sexy body, make your partner come alive. If you can't do that, don't even try. So get yourself together and learn it quick. Just get on the floor and
Throw the D.
Which became a hit, despite the group's name on the label. I saw this the other day being spelled with an extra O.
Yeah.
Was that intentional or was that a misprint? What was the story with that?
Probably was a misprint. I'm pretty sure it was a misprint because back then, we, like I say, if you look at the original records, you see all kind of misprints, everything going on. Because I was, you know, here I was this young guy not knowing what I was doing. I was just printing up records, finding somebody to make a label, finding somebody to make the vinyl. You know, I learned, you know, I was actually in some of the vinyl pressing plants, you know, pouring vinyl in the machines because, you know, I had to make these records so fast and we other places wasn't moving fast enough. So it was kind of crazy. I mean, I did everything to make records back then.
So you made an album like 85, 86, you decided to do an album. And while that seems natural now, there weren't really a lot of rap albums back then. It was pretty much more of a singles industry. Why'd you decide to do a record?
Well, I thought when I looked at the industry as, again, I had to went and doing all this research, doing all this, you know, understanding the music business, you know, talking to distributors, you know, at the radio station, you know, all parts of the business, going to these music conventions, listening to these people talk about singles, you got to have a hot single. I then said, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take the single and set the single up to then force people to buy the album. So I knew, all right, look, I'm only going to make this amount of money on a single. Then what if I take the single and cut it off, which I could do because I own the record company. I'm not on a major label. With a major label, their whole goals were to get this gold and platinum single and then put out an album. You know, that was the thing, singles back then. And I was like, look, I'm my own record label. I could put the album out at a discounted rate and still make more money profit-wise by putting out an album. So I said, okay, I'm going to use the single to sell certain amount of records, and I'm going to cut it off. Because my goal ain't to sell singles. We're trying to sell some albums. So what I would do is get the single hot and cut it off and force people to buy the album. And that started a whole movement into people looking at, you know, those strategic moves that I was doing. And they then took that on. The entire record industry started doing basically the same thing, taking the singles to set up the singles to sell the album, which, you know, obviously the internet blew that up because right now everybody is going back to straight singles.
Yeah. And so one of the things I was surprised to find out about is, you know, in the early days when you guys would do tours in Europe, you were as likely to play an acid house party as you were some kind of hip hop show.
Yeah. Yeah. In England, we would do acid parties. Not necessarily. I think we probably did a couple shows, but in England, more acid parties. In France, Holland, we'll do regular clubs. In Japan, regular clubs in Japan, things like that.
Did you see any connections music-wise between kind of the acid house scene in England and what you guys were doing, the Miami-based thing?
At that time, it was mixed up with everything. I mean, we would do those parties, and then you'd have people like Public Enemy and different other artists performing also. So those were like going in real fast and going out. Because, you know, obviously it was illegal. People would be sitting there getting a telephone call at a telephone booth and then rushing to the party. And you got to rush in and rush out. So I wasn't able to sit there and really appreciate the parties like you would normally appreciate a different kind of party by sitting there looking and observing.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. If it could be busted at any minute, you kind of want to make sure you
want to go
thing,
in,
get your money and get out.
You want to go in and get out.
Yeah.
Sometimes we didn't do the parties because it was just too hectic.
Sure. So one kind of hidden corner of your catalog that I really like is some of the stuff you did with your cousin, the group Enquête. So there was that Janet Reno song, which might sound kind of funny to people, but she was very, very popular, especially among Black women at the time you did the song. Can you kind of explain what led up to the creation of the song Janet Reno?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just like you say, she was very, very popular, you know, and one thing about me when I'm creating, I try and create things that people can relate to, you know, and so in Miami at that period of time, she was the state attorney. All women loved her because her old claim to fame was, you know, if guys didn't pay child support, she would put them in jail. So every African-American man was scared of Janet Reno, and every African-American woman loved her. You know, this lady would go be the only white lady walking down Martin Luther King Boulevard at the MLK parade, you know, when any other white person would be scared and people would be applauding her and cheering her. And, you know, they just loved her. She was like a god around here. And so it was, you know, it just dawned on me one day, man, I got to make a song called Janet Reno. And, you know, I got my little cousin group, you know, I'm going to let them do it because they're girls. And then, you know, kind of went into the studio, gave them the idea, wrote it up, and put some nursery rhymes to it, you know, like Old MacDonald, you know. So we just took, you know, Janet Reno, come to town. Da, 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 da.
All the money you get, all the checks you make, Janet Reno will make sure and take.
And then added that to it, and before you know it, it became a hit record around here.
And that record actually got you in a little bit of trouble. It was indirectly kind of started the whole censorship crusade, right?
Yeah. What happened is here we were doing a record and put the record out, not knowing that the following that same year, she was running for re-election of state attorney. I didn't know nothing about no election, nor did I know anything about her running for her seat again. So at the time, Jack Thompson was running against her, and he obviously thought that, you know, this was some kind of political movement on our behalf of making a song to promote her.
Right.
So he took it as if, oh, these guys are promoting Janet Reno, then all right, I'm gonna go after them, and y'all have hurt my chances of being elected. So it became this whole issue of fair time on the radio station, because the radio was like, yo, we got this guy complaining because it needs to be fair time. If you do a song for her, then he needs to get the same amount of time. So we couldn't actually get the record played on the radio during the election time. So I guess when the guy lost, then that's when he came after me personally. And then, oh, by the way, I'm in this group, Two Live Crew. So he then, you know, got smart and say, hey, look, I'm going to just latch on to this whole explicit lyric, promoting this to children and all that. And that's how he created that whole scene. And once he did that, he ran with it, but it was all because he was upset that he lost to Janet Reno. It wasn't something that he created from, oh, I got a problem with them doing records and the music is getting to the kids, everything, and most people don't know this. Everything was because he lost the election and he was, you know, being vindictive.
Yeah. And so, you know, that started the whole crusade, and you actually had an obscenity trial for the record, which you ended up losing at first.
Yes.
And I have to ask about this. Is it true you actually made the judge watch porn during that trial?
Oh, we made him watch and listen to everything. I think we made him watch it. I'm pretty sure we did, because it was, I mean, I want to think we made him. I mean, It was everything, because again, you know, it was, you know, the whole case was based on the Miller test, you know, and what appeals to period interest and that whole 3-prong test, you know. So it was, if this was what's in the community, if it's porn, if it's a porn store, if it's these type of music, the dice plays and all these different things, then this should be accepted in the community. And I guess the judge was on his idiot juice that week or something else, and he obviously ruled against us.
Right. So during your whole censorship crusade, he's been a great friend of the show, someone we've had on a bunch of times. Bill Adler was a big supporter of yours.
Yes.
What do you remember about Bill and his efforts?
Yeah, Bill and his efforts were great. Bill would write these articles and columns. He pretty much let the world know what was going on outside of Miami, because, you know, not too much hip hop reporting was coming from here. And Bill pretty much let people know what was happening at the time. And he eventually became a great friend.
Excellent. And there's one other moment in, you know, sort of the whole legal thing I want to hone in on, which is, you know, you had Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates, as an expert witness.
Yes.
That's been talked about a lot, and what he said and how he set you guys in a historical context, kind of going back to Shakespeare.
Henry Louis Gates Jr. is the Alphonse Fletcher University professor and the director of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University. He is also an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, literary scholar, journalist, cultural critic, and institution builder. He is also the recipient of 53 honorary degrees and numerous prizes. He was a member of the first class awarded genius grants by the MacArthur Foundation in 1981, and in 1998, he became the first African-American scholar to be awarded the National Humanities Medal. You may also remember him as a participant in President Obama's beer summit after he was wrongfully arrested entering his own home on the Harvard campus, and as the host of the television show that discovered Ben Affleck had ancestors who owned slaves. In his 1990 essay, Two Live Crew Decoded, Gates talks about the historical context surrounding Two Live Crew's work. The essay reads in part, "In the face of racist stereotypes about black sexuality, you can do one of two things. You can disavow them or explode them with exaggeration. Two Live Crew, like many hip-hop groups, is engaged in sexual carnivalesque. Parody reigns supreme. From a takeoff of standard blues to a spoof of the Black Power movement, their off-color nursery rhymes are part of a venerable Western tradition. Two Live Crew must be interpreted within the context of black culture generally, and of signifying specifically."
And so you're there in the court, and you're hearing all this.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it like for you to hear, probably learn stuff about what you were doing, like the context of what you were doing, from this guy?
Yeah, it was actually amazing. When I sat there, you know, because, you know, Bruce was telling me, yeah, I'm going to have this scholar, Henry Gates, come in, and he's going to testify. And when he brought him in, and I saw that, you know, I started listening to him talk, I was like, okay, you know, hey, you know, I didn't know, but as the cases went on, and as he spoke, you know, I learned a lot more about myself and about what we were doing at the time than I even could have imagined. And that's why, again, it's so, you know, it's so important to talk about history before you talk about the present. And that's why, like, you know, going back to the original question, you don't know that you're creating history. You don't know that a lot of this history is repeating itself until you really find out. You could talk to scholars, and you could talk to people who have seen and heard these things before, and they could bring it into perspective. And what he did is he brought it all full circle into perspective, things that we were just doing just because. It wasn't like we were doing anything, you know, out of an ordinary. It was, okay, this is what these guys are doing. And, you know, when you talk about history and art and different types of art, you know, and learning, and then, you know, that makes me as a person start thinking more about art and looking more into different types of art to understand what art really is.
Speaking of making history, you made history in a sense by being a character on Saturday Night Live, like 1990, 91. You know, Chris Rock played you on a couple Saturday Night Live skits.
Come on, girl, and get on your knees and nibble on me like a rat on cheese.
Yeah, having a good time, Luther? Everything okay?
Yeah, man, everything's all right, man. Everybody's just treating me nice. Everything's just cool in the game.
Good, good. Now, I want to talk to you about the tour. Excuse me, fellas. It's nice to meet you. My name is Victor LaCroix. I work in accounting here. Luther, I really like what you're doing.
Thanks a lot, man.
Listen, I hope you don't mind, but I dabble in songwriting myself, and I wrote a little something I think you guys might really be able to use on your next album. You mind if I run it by you?
Nah, man, go ahead.
Okay, here we go. Do it. Do it in the butt. Do it again, my back-end friend. Well, what do you think?
Well, you know, man, it's good, but there's a lot of back-end records out right now.
Do you remember what it was like to see that?
Oh, man, that was totally funny. For him to have a gap teeth, and I sent him I sent the show some scarves, so I wanted to make sure that they had the right scarf on. Yeah, that was real. That was real funny. You know, that was almost like, oh man, we made it, and it was. It was real funny. He did a great job. I always tell him every time I see him, I'm like, yeah, I'm responsible for making your career, because if you never did me, you'd still be on Saturday Night Live right now.
That's great. And, you know, that came out kind of right around the time, that skit right around the time of the Band in the USA album. And on the tour to support that record, you were dodging arrest basically every night. What was your best strategy for dodging arrest after a show?
Man, let me tell you, it was like a cat and mouse game. Because just like you say, I would go into the city, kind of get a good idea as to what we could do and what we can't do. Some cities like Cincinnati, every place I went, they kind of modified. It seemed like the police departments in the different cities were communicating with each other. So, you know, it got to a point where, like, one time I was in Jacksonville, the cops came to the side of the stage and it was like, yeah, we're going to arrest you after the concert. We're going to put you in jail after the concert if you do these type of songs here. And they would be standing on the side with dogs and a bunch of police in the curtain, in the side of the curtain where the fans couldn't see it because they didn't want to do it. If I sung the song, they wouldn't do it because they didn't want to have a riot. So I would sing the songs anyway. In my DJing days, we used to do like this little pyro technique thing where we would have these little bombs. They probably call them pipe bombs now. But we put gunpowder in, and I would tie the gunpowder up with electrical wire, and then we would stick it into the socket, and then it would spark the gunpowder and blow up, and it would leave you temporarily blind for like 10 seconds. So I started taking that stuff on the road because that's what we used to do at the dance. So I would take that stuff, that pyro, and put it on the stage, and we ended up making switches for it. Instead of just sticking it in the socket, we would make a switch for it. And then I tell the guy who's in charge of hitting the switch, when I'm getting ready to escape almost to the end of the show. So I would do this damn Houdini act and be like, you know, I give him a cue like, yeah, drop the bomb, boom. And, you know, before, while the show going on, I'm like, yeah, we got all these police over here. Fuck them. I'm going to do my show. They ain't going to tell me what to do. Fuck y'all. And they'll be standing over there like, yeah, we're going to put your ass in jail sooner. You know, we can't go out there knowing that they couldn't do it while I was there. And the people were all revved up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And by the time the show ended, you know, I would be like, drop the bomb. And I'd jump in the audience, take off my shirt. I would have two different shirts on and hop in anybody's car that was at the venue. And there were a couple of times in Detroit, I hopped in some girl's car and they were like, oh my God, we got Luke in the car. And I was escaped in Jacksonville, hopped in somebody's van, drove me to a plaza. I escaped in Orlando. By the time I got to Cincinnati, they had us all blocked in. They had helicopters, snipers on the roofs, horses, and everything. So that was pretty much one of the only places I couldn't escape that I had to tone it down, which to this day right now drives me, that I really should have went to jail.
Right. You talk about how that was kind of the beginning, that night was kind of the beginning of the end of the group. And I wanted to ask about that larger dynamic, which is like the other guys in the group, the other lyricists didn't really, although it was mostly their lyrics, didn't seem to much care about the legal stuff and would, it seems just as likely, would not have dealt with it if it was up to them, right?
Yeah. No, they basically didn't care. I mean, when you look at all the pictures of the trials, and even the final trial, it eventually always ended up being me in the courtroom. It was always me, and it wasn't by choice. It was by, okay, you need to be involved in this. I guess when you're paying the bills and you're footing all the bills, which I did, they didn't pay anything. It became my case and my trial, even though I was a large part of defending majority of their lyrics, because, you know, if you just look at it from an artistical standpoint and lyricist and the things that I wrote and the things that they wrote, I was more so defending what they wrote, because the things that I wrote wasn't as bad. You know,
and you didn't even really rap that much on the records till, you know, no. The band in the USA, at which point The group was sort of on its way to breaking up.
Exactly. I mean, that was, yeah, and my stuff wasn't as hardcore. So, you know, again, I was fighting the battles because, again, I was built for it. You know, I stood out front, you know, I took my hard earned money and fought him. When I had to fight George Lucas, I had to fight him. And I ended up paying the bill.
Early in his career, Campbell adopted the nickname Luke Skywalker, but with two Ys. Despite the fact that George Lucas himself had signed a release years earlier, Luther was sued by Lucasfilm in 1990 for using the name, and ended up paying a settlement of around $300,000.
And I, you know, paid all the other legal fees, and just like I say, the guys, they didn't want to fight that.
Yeah.
And so it was basically me.
Mm-hmm. And so that leads me to something I was wondering about with your solo career, which is, you know, you had a hand in pretty much every aspect of Two Live Crew except the lyrics. And then all of a sudden, you are going solo and you have to deal with that aspect of stuff as well. What was that transition like?
Yeah, I mean, when we created a Two Live Crew song, we were basically, me and Mr. Mix, you know, I would come up with a song and kind of tell him some of the songs that I liked to sample, and he'll add some other songs. Then I would come up with, you know, the outline of the song. Like, take for instance, Me So Horny. You know, I'm sitting here looking at Full Metal Jacket, the movie, and I'm seeing the lady, you know, on there talking about Me So Horny, Me So Horny.
Hey, baby. You got girlfriend, Vietnam? Not just this minute.
Yeah.
Well, baby. Me so horny, me so horny.
You keep lying.
Me love you long time.
Then the mass production song that we didn't use, which was one of the songs that I would DJ. And that, going back to one of your questions, some of the songs that I DJ, majority of the songs that I played, whether it was Mass Production, Herman Kelly and Life, those were the songs that I told Mr. Mix to sample, because those were the popular songs that were in the clubs at the time. You know, so the songs were already hot. We would just add a beat on top of Herman Kelly. We'd add a beat on top of Mass Production. So I would say, sample this song. This is one of the hot songs down here, because you're talking about guys from California don't have any idea as to what we like in Miami. So I would sample this song right here, and then I would come up with the concept of the actual song, like, you know, like Me So Horny. Hey, Mass Production, use that. That we haven't used that song before. And then here's a sample here. This lady on here talking about Me So Horny, then go into the studio and tell the guys, okay, this is what it's going to be. This song is going to be How Horny You Are, Me So Horny. So talk about a story of you being horny, the time that you're horny.
Sitting at home with my dick hard, so I got the black book for a freak to call. Picked up the telephone, then dialed the 7 digits. Said, yo, this Marquis, baby, are you down with it? I arrived at a house, knocked on the door, not having no idea of what the night had in store. I'm like a dog in heat, a freak without warning. I have an appetite for sex.
Let me write some of these things down. Let me hear what you're talking about. See whether it makes sense. And then we go from there. Then mix, you put it on this track right here with that sample and that hook. And there you have a Two Live Crew song. That's how I made them every day.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that big a stretch to go into just making an entire song beginning to end by yourself, including some of the lyric stuff.
Nah, it was easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was doing it anyway.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, because everything was concept driven, you know. And so once I tell you the concept, hey, look, we're gonna make a song about fish jumping in the pool. So describe, you know, hey, fish jumping in the pool, and here's the hook: fish jumping in the pool, shift jumping in the pool. And so now you got to talk about the fish jumping in the pool, you know. Hey, look, the fish jumping up in the pool, and they jumping up and down, they jumping all around, they jumping out of here, fish jump, get this fish jumping back in the pool. And that was the hooks. And you had the beat, so it was all no-brainer. It became easy.
You know, I did want to ask, you did a song with Biggie, and I re-listened to it before I talked to you, and there was something in it which I hadn't remembered, which is he ad-libs one of your famous chants.
Hey, hey, in my head.
Hey, hey, in my head.
Right, the head, head, and more head chant at the beginning of the song.
Representing for
yeah.
Bitches. Head.
Head. Oh,
head. Check it out. Check it out now.
Yeah.
So he was a fan?
Oh, yeah. He was a big fan. I mean, me and him, and if you notice, I didn't do too many songs with too many people because I just really didn't believe in just doing songs with people that was just hot. You know, Biggie, you know, I brought him down and he performed at the Pac Jam Team Disco. A couple times we created this bond, me and him, you know, the other guys in the group, his managers and all that. And we just, you know, we always talked, hung out. You know, I would go to New York, I would hang out with them. And we were just real good friends, you know. And he told me about his stories about, you know, him, you know, starting and wanting to be involved in hip hop. And what was kind of shocking to me was, he liked it, one of my groups, which was the Poison Clan. And he was big fans of Poison Clan. And he was very familiar with all the music that I did. And he would sit there and recite the song. And, you know, and so I was like, man, you know these songs. Hey, we need to do a song together. And it was just real easy to do a song with him.
And, you know, just in the last couple of minutes here, I wanted to ask you something about a little more serious, or much more serious, which is like, you know, we're talking only a few days after the incident in Charleston and some of the dynamics there in that terrorist murder. One of the things that's been said in the press about that is that one of the things that got him angry was this idea of a black man dating a white woman he had a crush on. And it shows that this kind of mix of racism and fear and sex that you talk about in the book is still kind of alive and you know, sadly still very strong now. And I guess I just wanted your thoughts on Charleston in light of, you know, what you've experienced about, you know, racism and fear around sex.
Man, I mean, that's that whole thing is real, real crazy. I think what people are not doing in the press, they're not taking responsibility for that. You know, people like Rush Limbaugh and O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly and Fox News and other outlets are not taking responsibility, because you got to understand, me and you, we may have a strong mind, we can listen to things and we could say, okay, you know, that's bullshit. We got we have a strong mind and we're a lot more intelligent. But then you have some people that don't necessarily have a strong mind. If you keep promoting that propaganda to them, this race hate on a continuous basis, then you find them saying the same thing. Like this kid, you know, I listened to Ann Coulter the other day on Bill Maher's show, and she's promoting a book, and she's saying basically the same thing that this kid said about African Americans and Latinos in her book, which is a very influential Tea Party Republican lady, you know, making the same statement about Mexican.
I think there are cultures that are obviously deficient. And if they weren't deficient, you wouldn't be sitting in America interviewing me. I'd be sitting in Mexico. You fled that culture because there are a lot of problems with that culture. Hopefully it can be changed.
The same thing Donald Trump makes the same statement about Mexicans.
When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
Well, you might as well go ahead and say Mexicans and African Americans because we all joined together. You know, you're not saying African Americans because it'll get you a little more heat, because you do have a few African Americans that's in the Republican Party as well as the Tea Party. So you don't want to say that, but by saying it about Mexicans, you're using the same talking points. And what people fail to realize, if we may not sit there and look at Fox News, I sit there and listen to Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, their rhetoric on a consistent basis. But when you have three different people using the same speaking points and one guy saying, ain't nobody else going to do it, I'm going to just go kill some people. You know, that's what's being promoted within their community. We don't know that. I don't know it because I'm not going to sit there and listen to Rush and Bill O'Reilly too long. I can't listen to Fox News too long, but only thing I could do is look and see this is what you're talking about. You know, and then here now you got a kid with a weak mind. You know, Trump ain't going to do it, but he's doing the same thing. Him and that, they're doing the same thing. They might as well take the gun and put it into a weak-minded person hand, and that individual does something about it. And the saddest part about it all, the kid is probably going to have millions and millions of dollars put into a legal fund, which means there's a whole lot of other people in this country feel the same way. But again, they have that right. But going out and murdering people, I don't think you have a right to go and murder people. You can feel the way you want to feel all day. I mean, I fought for that right for you to be able to have free speech. But at the same time, now when you start killing people, you need to, you know, and you start stand up to it. That's what I did. I stood up to it. To whatever, you know, I stood up, you know, in the paint for the things that I said. And I think them people at Fox and Trump and Limbaugh and O'Reilly, they need to stand up and take responsibility for those people being dead. Because that's what they're preaching.
Yeah. And, you know, finally, one last thing. And again, I really, really appreciate all your time today. The guy who does our website is a huge part of the show, I think would literally quit if I didn't ask you about making the Professor Griff record.
Now to the man on the board who has very little meaning, don't make any ball, now it's time to start beginning. Not making it tough, but you have to use your brain. Think about it. We're like pawns in the game.
What we're going to do right here is go...
Oh, the Professor Griff record. Let me tell you, man. Let me tell you. Professor, again, like I say, he was one of my friends. I met him on the road with Public Enemy. And Griff was a great guy. You know, he was a great guy. I mean, I think at the time I didn't know. I just felt like he was getting a raw deal. I didn't really look into everything that was going on.
Richard Professor Griff Griffin was Public Enemy's road manager and minister of information. In March 1989, he gave an interview to the Washington Times, a notoriously right-wing newspaper owned by the Messianic Christian sect, the Universal Life Church. Griff made several anti-Semitic statements, including most famously, Jews are responsible for the majority of the wickedness in the world. After some vacillation by Public Enemy leader Chuck D, and even a temporary disbanding of the group, Griff was kicked out, though he rejoined some years later. Griff's first solo album, 1990's Pawns in the Game, was released by Campbell's label, Luke Records.
You know, I just, you know, hey, look, let me just give, let Griff do a record. You know, and then later on when Griff did the record, then I kind of learned more deeper into some of the things and some of the other feelings of people who he kind of hurt their feelings. But, you know, again, he has a right to free speech. So if I had to do it all over again, I probably would because, you know, he has his right. And those are the rights we stand for. And then again, I think with the record, it kind of helped Griff along the way, because I think some of the things that people had said about him was taken out of context.
Wow. And that sounds like a great note to end on. I would love to have you back at some point. There's so much we didn't even touch on, the Acuff Rose trial.
I know, anytime. Just hit me anytime. I'm here.
Absolutely. That sounds great. I would love to even just have a whole show about your memories of the old Jack the Rapper conventions and things like that.
Oh, man. Yeah, you. I guess you got to read the book, huh?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The book of Luke, My Fight for Truth, Justice, and Liberty City by Luther Campbell, out, you know, probably as you're hearing this. And thank you so much, Luther Campbell, for your time, man. I really, really appreciate it.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Josh, your producer. You haven't heard me yet, but I have one question if you're still there.
Okay.
The Two Live Jews record, please tell me you heard that.
Yeah, I heard that.
How did you even react to that?
I was like, this is a piece of shit.
Walking back to the hotel from the bagel shop. It was so damn humid, air was on us like a mop. I was shredding like a mule, I was frying like a blitz. I was swimming in my shorts, if you get the hint.
I was like, this is trash. I mean, you talking about, you know, somebody ripping somebody off. I was like, this is garbage. This is garbage. This is horrible. I mean, y'all ain't, I was like, man, y'all, I got a lot of Jewish friends. Y'all ain't representing my Jewish friends in the right way with this trash right here. Y'all making them look bad. I would remind all my Jewish lawyers and all that, look, You need to work harder for me, because you're going to be left with the Two Live Jews.
Amazing. It's amazing when you look at it exactly how influential Luther Campbell is. As the godfather not only of Miami bass, or even of Miami and Atlanta bass, but of Southern rap as a whole, he started a sound that has come to dominate all of hip-hop over the past decade. And as his memoir shows, he's acutely aware that the free speech battles he spent so long fighting weren't only about the right to say raunchy rhymes to an adult audience, but also about fighting deep-seated white racism and fear. When I was visiting my parents a few months ago, I found a middle school report I'd written about censorship. And featured in that report as a crusader against the practice, right along with David Vonarovich and all those metal bands fighting against Tipper Gore, was Luther Campbell. Maybe if I can find out what my sixth grade teacher is up to, I'll be able to turn this interview in for extra credit. As a side note, for a great picture of what the fights over music censorship were like at their height, check out Campbell's 1990 appearance on Donahue with his nemesis Jack Thompson. Uncle Luke is joined in his crusade there by Wendy O. Williams, Jello Biafra, members of Suicidal Tendencies, and more odd bedfellows. But it's Luther who really drives home how ridiculous the censorship crusade is. I'll put the link in the show notes. Join us in 2 weeks, as we're still on our July and August summer schedule. If you need something to listen to in the interim, go to theciphershow.com/archive and check out our back catalog. Our guest in 2 weeks will be producer K-Def. From his work with Marley Marl in the early 1990s to his innovations in recording software, he's had a wild ride. Plus, you'll get the inside scoop on what really happened between KRS-One and PM Dawn on that infamous night. As we mentioned at the top, make sure to subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, leaving us a rating or a review is one of the best things you can do for the show. If you want to go the extra mile in supporting us, visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow to make a donation. Even a couple bucks a month goes a long way. You can find The Cypher pretty much anywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. And you can find more information and playlists for this or any other episode at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sitaro.
It was on his idiot juice that week.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
By the time the show ended, you know, I would be like, drop the bomb, and I'd jump in the audience.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Printing up records, finding somebody to make a label, finding somebody to make the vinyl.
Special thanks to Gregory Henry at HarperCollins for helping to make this interview possible.
Hey, man, you want to be in the group? Okay, fine.
And special thanks to this month's biggest Patreon supporter, Bikram.
Knowing that the market was going to crash, to be able to take that little bit of money from them, then resell his house.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Headphones. Let me see. Hold on. Hey, Chris, you got headphones? Big booty hoes, help with it. Hoochie mamas, help with it. All right.